Studies and Marine Corps University presents The Pakistani Surge, Progress and Challenges, presented by Hader Moore. This is the 8th lecture in the series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled A Multidisciplinary Approach to the AFPAC Region and Its People. Mr. Hader Ali Hussein Bullock is a fellow at the U.S. Joint Special Operations University and the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. Additionally, he consults with government organizations and advises on security, diplomacy, governance, and development issues in South Asia. In the past, he has conducted research at the Brookings Institution's Foreign Policy Studies, U.S.-Pakistan Relations, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, Pakistan's Political Economy and Thriving Failed States, and the Hudson Institute's Center on Islam, Democracy, and the Future of the Muslim World, Madrasa Education, and the Links to Islamist Militancy. He's the author of Pakistan's Security Paradox, Countering and Fomenting Insurgencies. This lecture took place Friday, 9 July 2010, from 1400 to 1530 at Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Professor Robert Cruz from Stanford University, and he will be talking about the conciliation with the Taliban. That's not the exact title, but that's the subject. And if we get lucky to get the individual that we have been pursuing, Professor Jamal Elias from the University of Pennsylvania, we will have one more in September to discuss Pakistani Trump paintings and the message thereon. We talk about I.O. a lot. I think you'll be very surprised to see what other venues of getting people in there is, especially in the Pakistani realm, how these trucks work. And it is a very, very fascinating lecture that I heard at place. And Dr. Elias right now is in Turkey, but if he comes, we'll get there. Other than that, we'll end at that time. And as I have been saying, and Adam and I have been working on it, except for one paper, everybody else who's been here, their papers, including our current speaker, will actually give us papers, and we'll combine that in a volume that we published by the Marine Corps University Press, and we will distribute it to all of you and to the public in general. So this will keep on continuing. Again, all of these lectures, with the exception of one, are online, and if you want a DVD of them, please contact us. You'll get much better response from Adam Seitz, who's handling all of this than me, and Adam will either send it to you or give it to you. So we do have those available. So we will go way beyond this audience. We know for a fact that people, Marines and other armed forces members and others, are using these as faraway places as Helmand. We actually have information about that, which makes this, again, what you say here is continuing as part of the PME, the professional military education that we are conducting here beyond the walls of this very room. So without further ado, I want to introduce to you our current guest today, Mr. Hader Bullock, someone that I met in Washington, and almost immediately I was impressed by his depth and breadth of his knowledge. We use that word a lot, but actually it is wonderful to listen to him, and you learn from him. You sit down with Taylor and you actually learn from him. He is right now a fellow at the U.S. Joint Special Operations University and at the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. Mr. Bullock has done a lot of work with the government, including work with General Petraeus' office. He has worked on mainly on the Pakistan side of it. One of his publications is before you. If you don't have it, the copy is right there. Another publication, Pakistan Security Paradox, Countering and Fomenting Insurgencies. You can't get this because it's signed to me, but there it is, the copy. Hader just came back from Pakistan. I think he's going to talk about that. So he comes fresh from the region. One of the things we have done in this is not to just focus on scholars and academicians and journalists who only are from our region. We have tried to broaden out people who are actually going out. Hader lives in the United States. He is hopefully soon to become a U.S. citizen. But we also try to branch out and get people. Our last speaker, who actually is sitting right here, Abu Bakr Siddiq, comes from the region but has experience from here. So we try to, for our, for Marines and for whoever comes and listens to us, we are trying to make sure that people get an understanding that it's not one-dimensional, one-sided. And that, if we achieve that at the end of this series, I think we have done what we aim to, to understand the people of the region of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Heather, thank you so much again for accepting our invitation. It's all yours.
I'll stand up. Can everybody hear me? But thank you, Dr. Arzi. It just reminds me of the first time we met. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. There was a conference organized by the Brookings Institution. Probably the first conference that was focused on counterinsurgency in Pakistan. And we met and we stayed in touch, and I am honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And Adam, thank you for organizing everything around it. My job today is really to tell you the story of the Pakistani surge, how it came about. It's an ongoing thing, so with how far it has come since 2009. And Pakistani surge, or not just the military surge, but the political surge, the change in mindset that occurred in the spring of 2009 that totally changed the country. And the risks and challenges that remain, some of the innovations that the Pakistanis have come about by basically experimenting with their own version of counterinsurgency, a hybrid version of enemy-centric, population-centric, and their own version of PRTs, agency reconstruction teams, and then a whole litany of risks and challenges that remain, and what that means for our mission in Afghanistan, and what that means for the region as a whole. Now, obviously, this is a mouthful of information, and what I'm going to try to do is highlight some of the main things, so you can read, if you're interested, read the details of the story, 7,000-word report that's in front of you. And of course, I have just returned back from the region, so I'll be incorporating my findings and some of the success that we've had in training the Pakistanis in other areas that we unfortunately cannot talk about because of the high levels of anti-Americanism, but some of the best things that we have done that were primarily responsible for the success of the Pakistani surge. And that certain things that we have not done and the Pakistanis have not done yet, primarily I'm talking about the diverging threat assessment of the two countries. So very briefly, counterinsurgency 2002 to 2008, why did the strategy change, how much it's changed, and the planning and execution of the Pakistani surge that begins in spring 2009 and is still ongoing. Some of the early progress, noteworthy innovations that I talked about, Pakistani version of the integration plan, Pakistani version of the reconstruction teams, containing challenges, risks, and in with some policy guidelines. And some of these policy guidelines would give you an idea of where the region will be in 2011, between 2011 and 2013. Of course, this analysis is focused on Pakistan, so that's the lens I've used to understand or forecast what will happen in Afghanistan, with the underlying assumption that Pakistan will be playing a very, very important role. It's very important to look at exactly where Pakistan was. Sometimes in Washington and other places, we have too short of a memory of to see exactly where the country was. This is a nuclear-armed country with 180 million people. And the Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, and the syndicate pretty much controlled 80% of the north, the Khyber Pashtunkhwa and the Fatah. This is early 2009. And they had effective control and administrative control. So they were not only harassing people and killing people, but also collecting taxes. They had their own courts. They basically had out-administered the state, 80% of the north of a nuclear-armed country. If you compare that to our strategic interests in Afghanistan, it's apple and oranges. This is where the real trouble was. Politics, no one wanted to own the war. This was the time when you had Mujahid Ahmadinejad, which was an Islamist group of political parties that were in charge of then known as NWFD, Nunhwa province, were never really on the war, were not either convinced or certainly were indirectly supporting the insurgents by actually creating an environment where they could operate in the space, the political space that was given to the insurgents, the TDP, Pakistani Dada. Nobody wanted to sell the war in the media. And the clergy, the religious community, nobody wanted to sanction the war. In fact, everybody was against it. The famous analogy of the puppet and the puppeteers, the puppets were Pakistani government, puppeteer was the United States. What kind of an army goes and kills their own fellow citizens and fellow Muslims? Troop morale was very low. At one time, there were about 4,000 insurgents of the Frontier Corps. That means 4,000 people that said either ran away or AWOL or did not follow orders. Many of the regular army also stopped following orders. It was just terrible times. Intelligence network mostly destroyed. 80% of all assets were killed in all of Fatah. That means they were going in blind. Afghanistan was the forgotten war. We didn't care about Afghanistan. And then the Pakistanis were stuck with this situation. Extreme mutual mistrust. We started with drone attacks when we would call them up, have a nice discussion of 2 hours, went from 2 hours to 45 minutes to 5 minutes to 10 minutes after the fact. And things were really at a point, this is of course early 2009. The worst time period was, of the insurgency was between 2007 and 2009. The approach was coercion without sound intelligence. So the coercion school of thought. It's very important to see exactly how they were operating. So the underlying philosophy was the Roman model, going strong, put the fear of God inside these people, and somehow you basically out-terrorize the terrorists. So, and I already talked, some selective counterterrorism, very effective against Al-Qaeda, but not effective against the insurgents. Blow up, patch up, blow up, pretty much. Blow up, then you patch up. In other words, you have these sham peace deals. Every time they had a peace deal, unfortunately for us, 300% increase in cross-border attacks every time. So 2006, 2007, 2005. A lot of artillery, a lot of tanks, a lot of air power. You look at the collateral damage from Pakistani fighter jets and compared to the collateral damage from drones, and again, sample and orange is a huge number. And then the whole idea was somehow this was enough. It's also important to look at the politics of the region at that, politics of the country at that time. You had a military dictatorship, you had a general in charge who was spending 90% of his time fighting off the judges that were directly challenging his rule. About 10% of the time was spent on counterinsurgency and to fight the war. His deputies, many of the deputies, the famous one, General Kani, was mostly handling the war even before he took over. He comes on, he was Director General of Military Operations, then he became head of the ISI, and then eventually he took over. Diverging threat perception, very important for us. Both Al-Qaeda was number one. I think hands down, nobody really ever questioned it from the beginning. The Afghan Taliban Haqqani network were never part of the whole between 2002 and 2008. In fact, Afghan Taliban were protected and the Haqqani network was not touched. For us, we didn't really understand Pakistani Taliban for a long time. We kept on conflating the two, and we didn't directly target them. Pakistanis believed Pakistani Taliban were largely reconciled, so that's where a lot of these peace deals came in. There was a lot of pressure, political pressure to do that. This is how the map looked like. So in April 2009, the dark red is effective control of the Taliban. This is, again, a nuclear armed country with 180 million Muslims, most of the Muslims. And this was the situation. So if you look at April 2009, where a lot of people complained about we're losing the war in Afghanistan, this is what was happening next door. And a again, it can't be compared to the kind of problems we had in Afghanistan. We still have that if we were to expand that argument. Bajor was, why is Bajor green? This is where our experiment started in late 2008. I call it the Bajor experiment, mostly led by the Frontier Corps paramilitary force under General Tariq Khan, Major General Tariq Khan. And basically, after destroying the first three villages, some of the junior officers came to him and said, you know what, perhaps we shouldn't destroy the fourth one. And he said, well, what should we do? Well, we need to come up with something different. We were certainly trained to go after the enemy. We are not trained to clear an area and then hold it. We clear it and then we come back. But we should start, we should be smart about this, put pressure, military pressure, but then trying to get some of the locals on our side, which will give us better intelligence, which would lead into the loop of better targeting, which would lead into higher troop morale, and eventually that cycle will produce some results. So this experiment started. Nobody noticed it because at this time, in April 2009, we were all screaming, Taliban 60 miles away from the capital. He was fortunate. Well, two things happened. Junior officer input was A, incorporated, which is unprecedented, and B, General Tariq Khan found an ally in General Qiani, and he brought out this plan. So the Bajor veterans, by the time they come for the SWAT operation, they're the only guys with higher morale. Everybody else thinks they're going in again for the fourth time to the SWAT valley, and again, they will lose. These are the only guys who have experimented. Again, it is very, very different from how we define counterinsurgency, and it is not a complete success. In fact, it's far, far away from complete success, but it is the beginning of change. When the next big operation happens in Swat, then after that, South Waziristan, we hear a lot about that. I'll go into details. But it's important to, it was important to lay out the foundation of where this country was and how important this country is for us and how important it is for it never to go into that deep hole again. These are the drivers of change. I mean, Army approval rating plunged. It was a 10% approval rating for the Army operations throughout the country. I already talked about that. ISI was attacked. Three of its major headquarters all over the country were destroyed. A three-star general, three two-star generals were killed. Mosques were destroyed. Shia, Sunni, Punjabi, Pashtun, mostly Pakhtun died, but as the onslaught just kept on increasing. And even though they controlled 80% of the north, they made sure that there would be enough mayhem in all the other major cities, including Rawalpindi, Islamabad, or Karachi. And that's where the real threat to the facade material comes in, because you have to have a map of Pakistan, look at the nuclear site, and where we believe that fissile material is, and then you look at the hotspots of insecurity, and that's one thing that started coming out. Doesn't mean that they can walk in and run away with a warhead, it just means that the overall technology becomes much more vulnerable for these kind of attacks. And then that's when the politicians and the religious community starts to flip. And you see the insurgents, you see the flip happening mostly because of this. Counterproductive insurgent tactics. I mean, two things they did. One, they started attacking everybody. You don't attack the ISI if you're in Pakistan and you want to stay alive as a militant group, period. The second thing they did was, of course, attack the army. And they attacked the army, women, army officers with their young kids would go to a mosque or other places, they attacked everybody. The second thing, the worst thing you can do for an army that is not trained in counterinsurgency is to appear to be a conventional force. These insurgents, when they started running different parts of districts, they became a conventional force. I knew where to find a Taliban leader because he was either a judge or a tax collector, or he's on the road. That's the worst thing you can do to a worst thing you can do for yourself. The best thing you can do for a conventional army. And so that's what happened then. The insurgents became a conventional force. against the conventional force that sucked at coin. And the Robin Hood image basically became tyrants. The minute they got power, they were less interested in justice and creating jobs, because running a place is always harder than campaigning to run for it. And they basically had these public beheadings, they closed all the girls' schools, destroyed most of them, you know, this goes on. And they started expanding to Punjab and Sindh. And I think that's another no-no, because most of the army is Punjabi, most of the elite is Punjabi. That's where the powerhouse is. And they started attacking the heart of Punjab from using their local connection with groups like Lashkar Taiba and others. And when all of that started happening, the politicians, basically in 2008, there were elections, and the Islamists were voted out. A new political party comes in. They try to do some peace deals in the beginning. If it fails, they flip. And then the religious community flips, because what they see, it's very hard to justify these attacks. And then, of course, the media brought in by the army, and the army chief, General Khan Sitsam, and all the Rush Limbaughs, and Sean Hannity, and says, you know what, you can hate me, you can hate everybody else, but you have to make a major difference between the puppet and the puppeteer alibi. And the idea was that you are the puppet of the United States, you're killing fellow Muslims. And that narrative stayed strong. And the way the Taliban justified it by saying, I'm not killing a fellow Muslim, I'm just killing the puppet of the United States or Israel or India. But now, the media started asking the question, I don't care if you're, if somehow, and then of course there was the narrative that the Taliban were being supported by India and Mossad and the CIA. So then the narrative changed, because people started asking the question, I don't care who supports you, you're still killing innocent people. So we're gonna still believe in conspiracy theories about who may be supporting you, but you're responsible for your own actions. So you killing somebody regardless of where the support comes from. And that was the real sea change that happened. And all these factors combined brought up that sea change. Approach started to change. And the fundamental change that happened was not because it was the right thing to do to protect population, but protecting the population yielded better intelligence, which led to higher troop morale. And that was the fundamental difference. When we made the change, we made population security and prosperity our end goal. For Pakistanis, it became a necessary evil slash very strong prerequisite for troop morale and troop coherence. But the bottom line was, they were securing the population for whatever reason. The strategies basically was primarily enemy-centric, started to become more population-centric, and they created their own hybrid. And they planned in 2008, after General Kiani called this commission, a secret commission was set up in early 2008, and all the generals that you see now, from Yassin, Asif Yassin Malik, who was the 11th Corps commander, or General Tariq Khan, or the Director General of Military Intelligence, and several other folks who are really calling the shots now, were part of that meeting. And the two questions he asked was, why are we losing the war? How can we turn this around? And that's where this holding plan came, and I'll talk a little bit about that. That's, again, 2008 is when the intellectual movement for the surge starts. And now it becomes very sophisticated. They start using a lot of special forces. They surround more, they use more, it's presence-oriented, they're declaring, and they start to stay. They have a long way to go before they can call it a success, per se, or the perfect way to do it. But it is, compared to the past, it was a very big improvement. And the tactics also changed. More precision weapons, their own UAV plan. I was briefed extensively on the Pakistani UAV, use of UAV and the UAV structure and how they're using them. And then just working with the locals whenever they could, but in a very different fashion, so they could yield better human intel and things like that. Some of it at least, okay? So that's the part.
But a lot of most political parties came out and they said, the turnaround happens in, again, April 2009. One of the last peace deals is completely disrespected by Sufi Muhammad, who's a local leader of TSNM, which is a syndicate of TDP, and he's basically in charge of SWAT. That was the best deal any insurgent could ever ask for. Basically, he got his own little state. And within 24 hours, he came on TV and said, I don't believe in the Pakistani constitution, I don't want to be part of this country, and by the way, I'm going to behead four special forces guys, broad daylight in downtown Mangora. When that happened, it was so hard to push for reconciliation if you were a politician, local or national. So you had to find a way, and the way they found was TDP, regardless of other groups, Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan had to be destroyed, period. Or it had to be degraded to a point where they could really negotiate from a position of strength. And do it in a fashion that they start losing a lot of their recruits and things like that. And that's where the media turned around that I talked about, and then clergy. Troop morale. You want to kill the bad guys and protect the people. And that was the fundamental difference. When they started to protect the people, the same people not only produced intelligence, but they made them feel better. And by the time they went home on break, they could talk to other people, because they would go back and people would say, why are you so proud? You're killing your own people and fellow Muslims, and you're coming back, and somehow this is our war. And now it was, well, they're not really Muslims. And the counter narrative was so strong, and it started to seep into the entire organization of the military. They could proudly defend their country. And they could say, you know, these are Muslims, and they're doing these things, they're destroying schools, killing children, blowing up people, and they're killing all these fellow Muslims. I'm just trying to protect this country. And that was a very thing. The counter narrative is extremely important. There were times in 2006 where the army would come and bring a flag draped coffin of a Pakistani soldier, and they would have all the elaborate musical instruments and speech, and then the army would leave, and nobody would pick it up to bury it. People just died by military funeral. And sometimes the body would stay there for 12 hours with a Pakistani flag. And that happened in certain villages. And so this is the kind of mindset. It's very important to look at Pakistani counterinsurgency from that context. Very important to know. Last time we fought anybody that we thought were against, well, we thought were people that we didn't agree with were basically the Native Americans. And so it's very important to look at exactly what the Pakistani community had to go through and the people generally. And they're still going through a lot. This is still a long way. There were also intelligence reforms. They have a long way to go, but they basically chopped out about 40 officers that still were in bed with TDP. They didn't get rid of the guys who were embedded in Karani, but they did get rid of people that were supporting Pakistani Taliban. They still need a lot more resources. We stepped in strong. We had training programs. We put in a lot of money. We gave them communication gear. Afghanistan helped because we put a new focus. We told them, listen, we're here. We might not be here long enough for you to feel safe, but we're certainly here more powerfully, we're putting more resources, this is our real focus now, this is our real war, and Iraq starts to wrap up, and Afghanistan becomes. There is mutual mistrust, but there's some decline, there's more intelligence sharing. There's some very significant joint operations on the border area. And overall, there is a need, you know, there are all these things that are happening in Washington, like the strategic dialogue and other things that show, and then General Petraeus really puts a lot of focus, but his personal relationship showed us at the moment. In 1 year, I think he's been there like 14 times. Mullen does the same thing, and really tries to bring the relationship back that was effectively broken after 1991, the Peshmerga, and then open up new slots in universities for more Pakistani soldiers and officers to come to the U.S. to get that kind of. And this is just a summary. Then comes the new plan, and I'll talk a little bit about it. The Pakistani Small Counterinsurgency Low Intensity Conflict Plus. The plus part they explain is as holding plan, which is basically what they call social action plan. I went all around the country. I was in Balochistan, I was in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. I had extensive briefings and saw them training right in front of me. And they basically shared their case studies. They shared the lessons learned, what they call strategic blunders, other things. It was unprecedented access. I'm very thankful for that. And for that reason, I have a fairly good idea about what they're thinking. And what they did was low intensity conflict plus. The plus part comes from a very unique place. Pakistanis, generally Pakistani Army, donates or grants the highest number of its soldiers to the UN peacekeeping mission. It's been doing it for the last many years. About 10 years ago, a Brigadier General Pakistani came back and started a school under the School of Infantry in practice called the Peace Building School or Peacekeeping Analysis. And that was, he and his colleagues had been screaming from the beginning, please listen to us. We have some experience in peacekeeping. We have some experience in stability operations. We've done them in Africa, Latin America. We work for the UN. We're like staring at you with this great resource. Please use us. Well, eventually in 2009, people started listening to them. And that's something that you don't hear about in the media. Very few people have talked about it. I've never even read it. And I was amazed because it was almost too good to be true because it was just staring at them in the face. And these guys became part of the decision-making process of the holding plan. And that's where the enhanced training is extremely important too, because we played a very important role behind the success of the Pakistani, of the relative success of the Pakistani surge. When we started the training program and started financing weapons, equipment to the Frontier Corps, there were 43,000 was the number, 4,000 insurgents, and 7,000 open slots. So that means open slot when we wanted. And now there are about 80,000. Every one of them has personal armor, 600 armored vehicles, personnel vehicles, 300 tanks, their own aviation. They have their own, basically they work with the Army, but they've been able to basically borrow several Mi-17 Cobra helicopters that are dedicated to Frontier Corps. Their pay went up 3 times. They have a pension plan, life insurance, which is very important to Frontier Corps. And basically, if you die, your wife gets a huge chunk, your children are guaranteed free education till I think the age of 18. The first son gets a part of this quota, so if he wants to join the Frontier Corps, and the list goes on. Most of that comes from the funding that we're giving and the training that we did. So it's very important. The second thing we did was the SSG Commandos, the Special Forces. There were about close to 3,500 SSG Commandos. Now they're close to 17,000. And that happened in 3 years. That means special forces. These are the best of the best. If you look at the SWAT campaign, and you look at these guys who came down from the helicopters, Hollywood style, and really able to do, you know, Call of Duty stuff, it's because of the stuff that we finance and train. And then they, in addition, train their own army. Train the trainer program was one, and then there were several others that were involved in that. Strategic communication changed because they started funding FM radios. In SWAT, and in SWAT, it was done mostly by a gentleman called Colonel Akil. He set up four FM radios. It was great because basically he made sure that the conversation was not censored. And they basically had a couple of good religious leaders on their side, guys who could provide the perfect counter narrative and could argue with the crazies. Crazies would call up, people like Sufi Muhammad and Fazullah would call up, and they would just start blabbering. They would just say, oh, just a second, there's somebody else on the line. And then they'll make sure they don't censor. The one thing that none of these guys had, the young insurgents, was they didn't have sophisticated or high level like religious training, so they could not quote the Quran as well. They could certainly not hold the argument. The other guys quote from Lahore, Karachi, and other places. They didn't call in. They would get frustrated and start swearing. And you hear all kinds of bombs going one way. They wouldn't censor it, make sure everybody hears it, and say, okay, that's how you feel. All right, next call. And they just kept doing this again and again, then expanded it to basically including, they created an FM 911 service, so if you were in trouble, you could actually call, and if you couldn't call friends when people started getting displaced under the Pakistani resettlement program, temporary resettlement program, they could call up IDP camps and get connected. They could also call up to find out when a USAID project was coming in. They would not start announcing it, you know, if you're a subcontractor interested in bidding, please be there. And just started expanding. Frontier Corps had its own program in Fatah. Both of them are so successful that both of them are being used for the same reason even today in July 2011, as I just said. This was very, very important. And it's just an example of a counter-narrative strategic communication IO operation. Public opinion changed. Right now there's a national level 80% approval rating for the Army. Approval rating goes down in SWAT and other places, especially if you talk to IDPs, obviously because they're not back in their home, you will have a low approval rating there. You have low approval rating as far as expectations. People will say, you know what, you cleared an area, you're holding it, why don't you start building? And to be fair to the Army, they never really promised building because they're even new to holding. So they're taking their time, and they're basically, there's a tussle between the civilians and the Army because the Army wants to eventually outsource. But, you know, it's like pitching, but there's no batter on the other side. And they're hoping that the civilians through the police and administration will be able to do some catch up by 2011. And there's some planning behind that. Overall, approval rating went up. There's still civil-military disconnect, and that, I just talked about that. And then I agree to discuss. This gives you some good numbers that are from the report. If you look at the numbers that were involved between 2002 and 2008, these are all estimates from several visits to Pakistan, several studies, interviews, not only with serving army but retired, and also a lot of defense analysts and Pakistani think tanks. All of those numbers together, I basically tried to come up with an estimate. Look at the jump on just an army, like a frontier corps. Police, you don't see a lot. This is very interesting, the enemy. It's very interesting because we put so much emphasis on what we're doing or our allies are doing. We don't talk enough about the insurgent strategy or what their numbers are, their lessons learned. It's equally important. This is a big number. And this basically included, you know, this is at the height of the insurgency. You look at Al-Qaeda, that's huge. This number right here, again, it's mostly because of the turnaround, the partial turnaround against Quetta Shura that happened in the last 8 months, which is directly contingent upon the situation in Afghanistan. They can capture and detain Quetta Shura and then let them go and protect them all over again within days. It's a very fluid situation when it comes to Haqqani and Quetta Shura because they are literally used as leverage. The other guys, for example, there's zero tolerance for TPP. If everything goes well and the Pakistanis go into North Waziristan in the next 1 month, we will hear, for example, we don't hear about TSNM, Tehreek-e Nifaz-e Shahid-e Mahdi, very, very big terrorist group, insurgent group, controlled most of the Swat Valley. Nobody talks about them anymore. That's for a reason. Most of their training centers have been destroyed. Some of their leaders are still at loose, but the actual supporting network, the logistics, the training camps, financial stream, other things have been destroyed. And Pakistani Taliban are significantly downgraded. In other words, Pakistanis have gained the initiative against the Taliban while we are still struggling to gain it in the south. They're way ahead when it comes to PDP. They have not touched the Haqqani network. The only guys that they have gone after were loose affiliates. Lashkar-e-Taiba has gone out. That's another group, very, very dangerous. Not only to the Pakistanis, but also the Indians and for us. And this group has actually increased because this is one group they didn't touch. They had their sanctuary, it's in southern Punjab. If anything. They become bigger, better, more trained. In fact, many of these guys are hired as consultants to go on detail to Al-Qaeda and go on detail to TTP. They're basically the brains of the insurgency there. And in Southern Punjab, they're very smart. They realize you don't want to become a conventional force. You don't want to run a state because then you're destroyed. They haven't done what they've learned the lesson from TTP when it tried to out-administer the state and then basically was destroyed. TSNM in the Swatlali, they haven't done that in Southern Punjab. However, they're capable of doing another Mumbai attack. There's intelligence reports about their plans to attack mainland China, Iran, and the list goes on. So this is a real problem. Sipe Sawa is another group. There's a close affiliate of Lashkar-e-Taiba. There are other groups, Jasir Muhammad, Asian Tiger, this goes on. They are part of this whole cabal. It's very important to look at all of this. Again, in summary, you protect the people because you want a higher public opinion and you want better intel. You don't do it because it's the right thing or you get brownie points. No. You do it to protect the military. The military has 10% approval rating, high levels of desertions. What do? Troop morale goes up, overall coherence of the military institution goes up. It started with that fundamental understanding, and then it started to spread it. You know, you kind of zoom out from there and everything, there's a ripple effect, and the politics, the religious community, everything is connected to this fundamental change that occurred. And for that, you're going to need more U.S. money, you're going to need weapons. They could have done this a while ago, but this is the strategic capitalist that was named primarily because of the insurgent behavior and the real threat to the nuclear armed country. This is one of the great success stories, primarily driven by the resources that we put into the Frontier Corps. Some of this I've already talked about, but I will go through this really quickly. I was there, Frontier Corps, that's General Tariq Khan. I was very lucky. We were supposed to have an hour and a half meeting, but the second meeting basically died off, and he said, "You want a drink?" I said, "It's too early in the day." He said, "No, I meant something else," and then we stayed for another couple of hours. So, great time, and he's one of the most brilliant proteges of General Kiani. Just like General Petraeus, General Kiani has also inspired a lot of Kianiites, and he's one of the Kianiites who's very inspired by him, is putting forward the vision, and he himself authored a booklet that will be released next month to all incoming Punjabi officers to the Frontier Corps about the frontier people, about the Pashtuns. And it's a fascinating read. It takes different things from literature, from poetry, from history, and I read parts of it, and you basically get this little booklet. It's a very different kind of a field map. I also got the chance to look at the Pakistani counterinsurgency doctrine. There is a doctrine. I was holding it in my hand, and I know a lot of people, including the RAND Corporation, said they still don't have it. Well, I was holding it 3 weeks ago. It's not the perfect kind of doctrine. They have a long way to go, but they still have one. And it came out of the kind of discussion General Academy had with the others when the commission was set up. Now you see a different kind of Pakistan. It's going after TTP. Certain Afghan Taliban are captured. And Pakistani Taliban are largely to be destroyed. And this is the plus sign, you know. So going after Al-Qaeda, Pakistani Taliban, and they're putting pressure on Haig. And the reason they're putting pressure on Haig is they want Haig to flip Bobadine and other of his proteges. That's the understanding I got. Haqqani, no way. Even when they showed me maps of Mir Ali, major city or town in North Waziristan, and I would have a pointer and I would say, okay, Mir Ali, Miran Shah, what about this area? You know, I'm talking about this, and the west side of the entire North Waziristan is spy network. And they would say, oh no, don't worry about that, let's go back there. So that they certainly don't want to go after him, primarily because they're hoping that he's going to flip, and I said this at the BTC in the Pentagon on Friday. Haqqani Network is effectively Pakistan's government in a box for RCEs. And they have a very sophisticated plan. They'll go district by district, province by province, and will tell you exactly what kind of person they want. Very sophisticated plan they're putting forward. They're already talking to Kabul about it to see. They might give up on some of the top guys that are very radioactive, but they certainly want Bakhti Aloya to have, at the very least, a very neutral kind of leader, so they never have to worry about that border. The south of Afghanistan, they have a similar plan. Again, they go from district to district, province to province. Here you see this, the new situation. These are really hot spots right here. This is Karachi. It's pink for a reason, because there's presence, but they're not effectively in control. They're still effectively in control of this area. It's all of Swat, most of the north. There are pockets here in Aurangzeb, some pockets in Moman Agency, some very little pockets in South Jiristan, where you see some Jiz people. This is the front that could open. And if you're a smart insurgent, you always want to open up the front, so you're under pressure. So you open up Balochistan. So they're in talks with the Balochistan separatists. You want to open up southern Punjab. Or the real game changer is just have another Mumbai, and these guys have to move. Because, and this is unprecedented, Pakistanis have moved close to 100,000 troops from the eastern border to the western border. They've never ever done that before, which is also part of the search. This is their version of the agency reconstruction team. Some of these teams are being activated in the fall of this year. Some of them are already activated. They call them collaborative teams. They're not sophisticated like ours. They don't have the kind of structures we have or resources, but they're certainly trying to create something close to that. Fatah Secretary is working very closely with the donor community, with the commanding officer for Frontier Corps on the army inside Fatah. But in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Swat Valley, frontier regions, other areas, you see some variation of this thing going on. Here, the real guy who turned around things was Lieutenant General Naveen Ahmed. He was hired in the summer of 2009 to basically head the special support group. And think of that as the UBRA PRT, like a UBRA National Reconstruction Mechanism team. And then he basically encouraged, through institutions that were already there, Provincial District Relief Reconstruction Resettlement Authority is already there. And basically what he was able to do is use the provincial and district boards and basically add a lot of other components and then try to come up with a homemade version of the PRP. Everybody in the CENTCOM and senior American leader, military and civilian leaders know him well from 2005. After the earthquake, he really turned around things. He got Hilal Imtiaz for that, one of the highest awards in Pakistan. So he's kind of someone like a celebrity inside the Pakistani army, and was able to basically, his single most important success was the temporary resettlement program. So 2.2 million Swatis were displaced, and within 4 months, 1.8 million came back. And 80% of their houses and businesses were intact. Partly because of they left, and it created an artificial space to troop ratio, which is something you really want in an insurgency. And because they did that, they were able to target the enemy, because the enemy could not be dispersed, because you need a population to disperse yourself in and hide yourself in the population. The population is forcefully moved temporarily. This is a very interesting idea. I've actually pitched it to CENTCOM, to pitch it to Afghanistan. As Afghan soldiers take the lead, there are many areas in RCEs where they can apply some of this temporary resettlement. The only thing is three major pitfalls. Last 40 years of counterinsurgency, including our Hamlet program in Vietnam, you don't want to be a foreign force, you don't want it to be permanent, and you don't want it to be corrupt or under-resourced, this whole thing. Reintegration, everybody's favorite. This holds. I first wrote about it last year. Nothing has changed. Regional talks, very important. Hague is already now pretty close. Many of his people are talking very closely. Then comes the regional settlement part. Again, India and Pakistan are talking closely now, even though the main culprit of the Mumbai attack is walking freely in Lahore. In fact, if we were in Lahore, we could get a meeting with Hafiz Saeed, head of the Lashkar Taiba. And even then, Indians and Pakistanis are talking. So it's unprecedented. They really want Afghanistan to be fixed, and they want their own relationship to go forward. Afghani and Mullah Omar are still question marks. And the hope is that some kind of grand bargain, the Afghani network, and not Mullah Omar per se, I don't think that there's a lot of love for Mullah Omar per se in the ISI, but there is love for some of the other guys who basically have the strongest connection to shadow governments in the South. And the hope is that when that grand settlement comes, a lot of these people will be able to flip, and when they flip, they'll be able to create what the Pakistanis call the firewall, the Western border firewall. And that's what they're asking for. And the Indians basically are saying, we don't want the return of the Taliban. We want to make sure there's no terrorist sanctuary. So they're hoping to create basically a win-win. If you have that kind of a baseline, you can't really declare victory in 2011, but you can at least say that you have begun the process of stabilizing Afghanistan. And it basically starts with this grand political settlement, and everything else comes under economics, more and more security problems, and everything else. Pakistanis feel very strongly about it, and they've become more sophisticated about it, and have actually moved away from traditional objectives of basically return to the Taliban. Now they simply want the firewall, they want Bakhtiar Loya and Southeast. And then they're pretty much honest about it. They, like I said, district by district, province by province, areas they would like to see. Indians, on the other hand, are also happy with having most of the central part. The Iranians would probably want something in the west. Obviously, all of this, I don't want to make it sound as if, you know, it's kind of one of those one-dish parties, everybody grabs something. But the idea is that, at least in the short term, for the next 15 years, Afghanistan will be in the dual trusteeship of India and Pakistan, or a regional kind of a pact, and then it will eventually earn its sovereignty and be able to basically sustain itself. In the meantime, these countries, basically the neighborhood, will be able to help this weak, poor country get up on its feet. And that's kind of the positive spin that they're trying to put in. And you can see that in all the economic transit, trade and transit agreement that's underway right now, all the economic ties, the gas pipelines, everything, the narrative will stay the same. Use this framework, everything will start to make sense of what they're doing. Eventually, in a perfect world, they're hoping, you know, there'll be more lessons learned, joint training. Pakistanis have already started a small training program. There'll be disengagement, long-term disengagement. Pakistanis and Indians will be able to get away. And the private sector will always obviously stay, Indian private sector, more so than the Pakistani. Again, summary. One thing that the Pakistanis have done really well is that Balochistan so far has been very quiet. I was in Quetta. That insurgency is just under the lid, and it can easily go up. And if you're a smart insurgent, that's what you're hoping for, is to open up that front. Sindh has been quite missing, basically Karachi, primarily because of a local political party called MMA, which basically has its own military wing. So if you screw with them, they basically launch their own little insurgents and growing. And they've done that. In the past 8 months, TTP, along with Lashkar-e-Taiba and other groups, Jamdullah, others have tried to open up these fronts in many ways. Now, you will hear stories. There's a bomb that went off, a targeted killing. That happened all the time in Karachi. Shias killed Sunnis, Pashtuns killed Urdu speaking, and then vice versa. But that's the baseline. That's a good news. If that's happening, that's a good news. What's a bad news is when the Taliban are kind of rolling in or trying to take over a city that basically is responsible for 30% of the GDP. No Pakistan or Pakistan-Iran. If you remember about a year ago, Jindullah was doing all kinds of crazy stuff, and Pakistan was able to actually capture the head of Jindullah and hand it over to the Iranians. And they, I think 3 weeks ago, publicly hung. That's probably going to Pakistan. It's destruction for Jindullah. And that means that the insurgents lost the kind of link they had. But they would love to open up Iran because they realized that Iran reacted in a way that was, they would really want to capture more Chinese engineers, open up the front, have a terrorist attack in China. That always rattles everything, and resources have to be moved, and that's somewhat like, you're under pressure, you want to open up another front so that the army can move around. India, we already talked about. Standardization, A is resources, B is just kind of a strategy. They're very neat strategies, so 10 times better than, say, 2008, but overall, it really doesn't integrate all the governance components, economic activity, corruption is rampant. Overall, the political disposition, the political party in charge, including the president, has a very, very low approval rating. So that's the real problem that they're trying to deal with. You still have variations in threat perception. They're not going up in a time. Southern Punjab, I already talked about. The level of anti-Americanism, part of it is because of history. Part of it is just miscommunications. We've done such a terrible job. I was with a three-star general, and he started saying things about U.S. Congress made no sense. I basically gave him a 15-minute 101 on Congress, and he completely understood why CSF takes so long. He also understood why money either doesn't come in time or certain measures of accountability are just part of how the United States work. On the other hand, when these three sergeant generals get closer to people like General Petraeus, they they expect General Petraeus to act like them. And if you're them, basically, you basically rule the country for 35 years out of 62. And that's not how it does. A hillbilly from Texas can scream down at a four-star general. That's America. That's how we operate. And we need to double that. And I was at ODRP, then I was at GHQ, Pakistan, Pentagon. And I was like, why aren't we telling them these things? I mean, one of our fears is that without adequate degradation, basically, we're trying to... We're very happy that they're going after TTP, but we want them to disrupt and destroy the network to a point where reintegration can start. Right now is not a good time. Some in the Pakistani military want to do it right now. These are future hotspots. We already talked about them. Southern Punjab, Balochistan, that's Karachi. That map comes from the report. You can look at it. Very briefly, because I'm out of time. Some of this I've already covered. Make U.S. strategy in Pakistan clear and consistent. That's what I said. Just make it very clear and very consistent. However, that does not mean it's not adaptable. We can still adapt, but we got to have a baseline. And I'm talking to people, just 2 days ago, I was talking to senior foreign policy advisor to Senator Kerry, and he said, if I don't know, I don't blame the Pakistanis. And that's a problem. Counter-narrative, very, very important. Whatever they're doing, keep doing it. But do it more, integrate it into a grand strategy that the military does, but also expand it to other places. Give credit where it's due, and criticism where it's due. And that's what we need to do. We can't live in a world where the surge did not happen. They did a surge, they gained the initiative, they're doing well, we need to help them. On the other hand, they could be far better if they take more of our help and actually move towards population security and prosperity more so than they are. They need to do it faster, they need to use more things, and cut back on corruption and other things. This is what I already talked about. We need to manipulate Pakistan's Afghanistan plan. We can't just reject it. These guys have to live with them for another 1,000 years, and they were there 1,000 years before we came. These are part of the neighborhood. They have to stay there. President Karzai has realized that. Pakistanis have realized that, Indians have realized that, China to some degree, as early as better. Help Pakistan is important, certain strategies are very important as we go forward the next 2 to 3 years. We'll see multiple fronts, we'll see some form of international mayhem that I already talked about, and this perception of blue schools, that's all they need to create. Insurgents just need to create that perception, and that's enough for us to take some drastic, ill-advised measure of going in special forces into Fata or other places to kill the nukes, and that's it. Then we have another a war at our hand that is going to be 20 times harder than anything we've ever done when it comes to counterinsurgency. In the end, I just want to say, this comes more personally, I think sometimes in the worst of times, we find the best in ourselves. And as we look at Pakistan, we see some innovations that we need to help. But we also see a lot of distress here. We see a lot of people questioning war. And perhaps years from now, when our kids are writing a dissertation about another war, the long war that we lost, we can talk about how we did it. But I think today is not that time. I think today is a time where we have a nuanced approach. We continue to do this kind of policy research, and go to our superior officers and planners and implementers of this war and tell them that you've got to give it your best before you completely become disappointed. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll take the Robin to ask you the first question. First of all, thank you very much. You have told us so much that I think the discussion could last a long time. You came from Pakistan. I was actually in the two countries that border Pakistan. While you and me spoke, actually, when I was in Kabul, so I went to India and then to Afghanistan. Just briefly, the perception, at least in those two countries, is that they understand the Pakistan plan, but they don't see it as just a plan that India would have an involvement in. One that India, that perception, at least in both in New Delhi and Kabul, is that Pakistan wants India out in every form. Maybe an embassy, yes, that's about it. So it was interesting that you talked about dual trusteeship. What you hear more from Kabul and New Delhi is Pakistani supervision, that Pakistan wants to supervise Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. The rest of it is pretty much what you said, is that the role of India there then is important. So I just wanted you to elaborate on that aspect, that, you know, here outside of the United States, and you're right, these countries will deal with each other, even when the United States is out of there. How genuine do you think that Pakistanis are in the concept of, let's say somebody accepts it, that they and the Indians will actually have an equal, but at least a partnership in working in Afghanistan?
That entirely depends on us. Our level of commitment and engagement, because we are the ones that referee these two guys in Afghanistan. If we back up and leave, then there will be another proxy war. And they know this. The only reason they would be willing to make sure that the firewall basically sticks with the western border and not make them another thing, but the Indians are more interested in economics, as you know, you were there. They really want to make a lot of money, and they want to invest a lot. Many of their multinationals are already buying up land in Afghanistan. The Pakistanis don't, A, don't have money, B, they're not interested, C, they're more concerned about the RC East and Afghanistan Southeast. If we leave, then we basically, we're a bunch of kids in the playground that will fight. We have to be the principal that has to stay in some format. Even if after 2011 we reduce our troops down to 40, 30, and then we move to training mission, all of that will still help because we're still there. And I think that's the most important part. And one of the reasons why the Pakistanis are moving away from their traditional thing is because Americans have, we have made sure that we give a very strong contradictory message. A, we're leaving, B, part of us will never leave. And they know that part that's not going to leave will be engaged, will make sure, for the Indian side, will make sure that Pakistan will not get involved in a full-fledged proxy war. However, if right now, if somehow we try to put pressure on Pakistan by basically having a pro-India or even President Karzai, if he starts installing governors after we start clearing and holding areas in the south of Luzon and the east, the Pakistanis are not consulted, and they are these guys who don't get along with them. Now, you were in Kabul when President Karzai had his favorite national security advisor near him. You know what? I was there when the ISI celebrated when both of them were fired. That was the biggest victory for ISI, and that was one way that Karzai could go into Pakistan and say, I am serious. I know you're an important player. I respect you, and I know the kind of influence you have in IRCs. These two guys who've been consulting with me, I know you can't even stand them, they're gone. And that again shows, A, influence of Pakistan increasing, but Pakistan always had it a lot, because you remember, we pretended somehow we could get rid of that influence. It was always there. Our job was always to manipulate it. And I think now the hope is that we can manipulate it for our best interest, and everybody kind of gets a piece of the pie.
Thank you. Please identify yourself and raise your question. Go ahead, please.
My name is Abu Bakr Siddiq, and I'm a journalist. I work for Radio Europe in Prague. I really learned a lot from your presentation, but I feel that a lot of it came from purely GHQ perspective in Pakistan. And there is a lot more to the story. What I gather from your presentation is that what we are likely to see in the future in the region is some kind of a settlement with Islamabad again emerging as a victor or a part of the victor, a group of victors. But there is an unanswered question here. The unanswered question is that what is the perspective that the way, I mean, for example, some of these things, frankly, as somebody who has lived in Pakistan, was raised in Pakistan, do not make a lot of sense. I mean, these tribal agencies are not that unknown to the Pakistanis as the Pakistani military might like, or Pakistani government might like us to believe. Fatah is, as you and I know, is integrated into Pakistan, not officially but unofficially. Masood's control half of Karachi's transport business. The Afridis have major trading stakes in what happens in Lahore. They pretty much control the Lahore dry port. And the list goes on and on and on. What is Pakistan's national interest in not integrating Fatah? What is Pakistan's grand vision for the Pashtun region, both in its inside its state and in Afghanistan? And from what I understand, and I was in Pakistan for 5 weeks in the past few months, is that the Kayani has reached out to Karzai. There is some level of understanding. But again, the major problem is that what Pakistan is pushing for is inclusion of more Afghan Islams in these regions, in the south in Kandahar. And these guys, frankly, cannot win an election in Afghanistan. A free and independent, they could have never done it. They will not be able to do it again. And what is our vision? What is Pakistan's vision, GHQ vision, for its own Pashtun region? They have given the name Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is a great thing, but they have not, the military, as far as I understand, from my sources in Pakistan, from Pakistani senior Pakistani politicians, most of them in the government right now, they said that we want to go ahead with reforms in Fatah. And that's the key. It can do more than whatever the agency, PREs can do. But the military is not willing to let us do it at the moment. So, I mean, just a general perspective on those things.
No, I think you make excellent points. It's very important, you know, I mean, it happens when you're trying to cover a predominantly military operation. It's very hard. And I started this way. I mean, I've been trained at the Philippine Institution. One of the things that we are taught is when you're in this kind of situation, just meet as many people across the board, Army, retired, Fatah Research Center, HIPS, we went to Peshawar University, Raipur, the Fatah Secretariat, the secretary head of that, all politicians, local, we actually traveled. And in fact, my next trip, I'm going to go all the way. And for that, as you know, you have to go through clearance, you have to go through a certain process for them to take you to these places. We can't just walk into the school of entry. And very important to look at the text they were using. There were major problems. For example, I got a PowerPoint presentation, and the first line was, Pashtuns are inherently militant. That was the first line. It was a Punjabi officer, and that was the first line of the PowerPoint. And I'm like, 25% of your army is Pashtun. You don't think that they're going to find that a little bit off? They're like, no, they know this. And this is a bigger agenda of saying, so yeah, there are real problems. And when their social action plan doesn't come even close to the kind of things that we envision and are actually doing in Afghanistan. But from where they were, they've come a long way. And that's why I always qualify that. The second thing is that I looked at the WANA program. Like, I was briefed on the WANA program. And for the next 2 years, the four storage units that are coming in, the power line that they're laying out, the road that they're building in lower South Waziristan, the welcome package that they're building for the Masoods who are coming, the first contingent is coming back at Christmas this year. And basically, and a lot of these people, you find people who are very ignorant, who love the back, you know, outerize and terrorize kind of situations, the Roman model, and others who, in fact, I thought I was very impressed by Yasin Asifaleh, who basically has this welcome package, but most of the Masoods are displaced. I think close to 200,000 are displaced from South Waziristan. Basically, if you look at South Waziristan, Masoods are like an egg, oval-shaped area. That all is empty. And what they're doing is they're doing quick impact projects. OTI, USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives, is working with them to build these power lines and some water supplies and others. And then future, to have this kind of cold storage unit so they can actually make Wana into an economic hub. Some of those things are happening. Some of that could just be a pipe dream, but at least on paper, and what I saw, and some of the things that were actually happening, not only that, but I went to USAID to find out if what they were saying was true or not. Seems like they've got the right things going. Then the criticism about the civilians is not so much party secretary or administrator or DCOs or former Nazims or members of the Provincial Assembly. Their criticism is mostly the bureaucrats who are in charge of the police or other areas or basic municipality issues, that they are not willing, there's a corruption, and they're not ready or trained to be dealing with post-conflict situations. They're already opening up SWAT to train these people. SWAT, for example, is very different. The civilians and the army are not getting along, mostly because of the DCO and the commanding officer. They have their own issues going on the personal level, but also institutionally, they're not getting along. If you go to the South Waziristan, there's a lot going on rapidly, primarily because everybody at least is on the same page. So I think it's nuanced. There are areas where you hear one part of the story. I've heard, like, for example, I've heard Fatah's activity is extremely corrupt. And then on the other hand, they said, no, Fatah's not that corrupt. Is, you know. So it's always, all we can do is we come back and we synthesize. We get all this information. And what I've tried to do is synthesize it into the best way I think. I mean, it is, of course, subjective. And maybe in a year from now, most of these things don't come true. But I think if all the details are backing, generally, that's where the trajectory is, progress and challenge.
Please. I'm Seth from the Department of Defense. One very quick factual question. You mentioned you went to a Frontier Scouts training center. Is that Warsaw?
No, I didn't go to Warsaw. I will go in August. But
where did you go?
This is the Frontier Corps training center that they have actually in Peshawar inside the big fort.
Oh, inside.
Yeah. Okay. And what they have, they gave me more of a demonstration, but they did suggest we have to go to Warsaw.
Okay. All right. And basically, just kind of a piggybacking on Barker's question. I mean, have the Pakistanis realized that the victory, the ultimate victory in this fight, is political? And that being said, is the governance of Pakistan, which is weak at best, and in mainland Pakistan, is that good enough for the product? I mean, does the tribal question want to be a part of that model?
You can answer this better than I can, but I'll take a stab at it. Again, it varies. Seven agencies, several different districts, northern Waziristan versus southern Masood versus Aziz, all the sub-tribes, MSA. There's, of course, a group of people, basically the carpetbaggers, who can't recognize their connection to the Fatah. Like, I grew up with a lot of Aziz and Sioux. They knew as much about Fatah as I did. I went to Fatah for hunting, and I skied in SWAT. That's all I did. I was born and raised, you know, I'm a Punjabi, so obviously, that's my prerogative. I'm just joking. But there are groups, there are areas that would want that, but I think what they need to work on is go district by district and have basically a roadmap for integration. And what they're doing now, for example, is a lot better than, about close to 600 Maliks were killed. The Maliks that have come up now, and the political agents that have come up, they don't have the kind of liberty they had before. Now the commanding officer stays with them. While they're giving out a subcontract or contract out, the donor will come, you'll have the Maliks, you'll have the commanding officer, and you'll have the political agent. And because the commanding officer is on the holding plan, he just stays there. So he's able to kind of keep a check on how money is spent. Then they're also, they're opening up bidding that they never did before. Usually there were fewer, more Maliks are getting involved, more tribes are getting involved than ever before. Again, they have a long way to go before this becomes really a representative of the place. Those areas will give you the best chances. And remember that before 1990, Northern Balochistan was part of the Frontier Crime Recognition. Okay? Before 1990. That's about 20 years ago. But they were able to make that. Now, when you make that move, you get into all these different dynamics. For example, do you keep the levies, this force, or do you place it with the police or not? And how soon can you make that transition? In Balochistan, they actually went in reverse. Recently, levies levies came back because the police wasn't effective. Levies are actually really good because they're recruited from the tribes. All these questions have to be put into a grand strategy. They don't have any of that going. But there are areas where they will do some pulling data, and they'll find out that they certainly want to be integrated, and at the very least, and there are different plans out there. There's a FATA as a province, FATA, they need to basically have this roadmap, so every 6 months they can actually stop and then evaluate how far they've come. So what exactly do they need in order to get to that point? And in the past, the last 20 years, to be fair, you have the Political Parties Act that was opened up, but it is shocking when a guy from Fatah comes in and is holding a Pakistani passport and a guy from Lahore is holding a passport. They don't live under the same law. And one of them is a second-year citizen. And because of the kind of religion and other things. But that's
I just...
you want to... Go ahead.
Just for a minute, I mean, on this question of, like, are the people ready? I think people are ready, and I think Pakistan, there's this window in Pakistan now, despite the violence and everything, that's the window that most people don't want to see or don't see. That Pakistan has a bright democratic future. But for that, I think the military has to make a great sacrifice. It has to permanently, in a way, abandon its future. I think in people have very wrong ideas about who the Pashtuns are and what they want. We had, in United India, we had the most political prisoners as part of, because the predecessor of Awami National Party, the Black Khidmat Guards, were allied with Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, with the Indian National Congress. And we had a great political position in that. And we have the best pacifist democratic movement, and that today is represented broadly by Awami National Party, but the whole entire political class in not only Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, but in Fatah and also in northern Balochistan. We don't have an insurgency in Balochistan. This is all, in a way, if you ask any Pashtuns, and I think now the public opinion has dramatically shifted, is that they want a normal life. They want all the rights that are enjoyed by all the people, but it's again in the Fatah has 8 MLAs, and they are not even part of, they're not supposed to legislate for the laws. They were sitting in the 18th Constitution Committee, and I met them, and they were not even supposed to vote for, the Fatah was not even mentioned in the 18th Amendment. So I think all these models of like levies and what levies are going to do or levies not going to do, levy was, for example, lucrative 20 years back or 30 years back, where there was no agriculture in northern Balochistan because it was, in a way, provided only sustainable jobs in, for example, Zhou or Pashin or Lorelei. But today, if you open up business, and regular business, regulated business with Afghanistan, where a Pakistani citizen holding a Pakistani passport with a visa or without a visa can legally go to Afghanistan, and an Afghan from Ghazni, from Jalalabad can come to Peshawar legally with a visa, freely, without paying bribes to Pakistani police officials. I think that's the future, the kind of future that we can have. And we can ease, and I don't think that the Pashtuns, either in Afghanistan or Pakistan, are an obstacle to that future, but it's the larger circumstances. And that's the understanding that people are now blaming their own failures on what poor tribes want or don't want.
Last question,
David. So thank you for your presentation, Greg. For the period between 2002 and 2008, what is your sense of the ability of the Pakistani government to detect what was going on and then react to it? Your window of opportunity in the counterinsurgency is limited, so And if they were successful, how did they do that?
It was very poor, primarily because of the actions of President Musharraf when he fired the Supreme Court in 2007, and also when he issued orders to storm the Red Mosque inside the Capitol. There was a big mosque, and basically a bunch of insurgents and terrorists had holed up there. They had weapons. They were challenging the state. He went in too strong. A lot of innocent young children died. That became the major impetus, plus the drone attacks for recruitment in the Fatah, and it really became a very, very dangerous situation. But you had a president who was fighting political power and not fighting the insurgents. They were in reactive mode, there was limited counterterrorism, no coin at all, no coin from our standards, zero. Some counterterrorism operations that were done in Swat Valley, they would clear parts of the Swat Valley, and then they would come back. There will be other times they will have. They were reactive mode, they were not proactive, they were not detected, they were focused on other things.
I'm sorry, I was there 2003 to 2005, and I've got a very different sense of the trajectory. I watched the major operation in Abu Bakr's home area, the Jukai Valley, in spring of 2004, and a previous operation in 2003. They weren't very good at it. The Pakistan Army had not been trained in counterinsurgency. Biggest single problem was that the U.S. government was pushing them to do things before they were ready to do it. You know, you do the operation first, we'll give you the training and the equipment a few years later. You talked about the MI-17s. They've been asking for MI-17s since 2001. I pushed within the U.S. government to get them leased MI-17s. It's because it's the best helicopter there is for high altitude operations. Our own Department of Defense and Congress said, hell no, we are not going to pay money to provide them a Russian helicopter. We are going to sell them and give them U.S.-made helicopters that can't reach up to the altitude they needed to operate. And we trumpeted that as a big success. Over and over again, we pushed them into operations that they weren't ready to undertake. What we're seeing now, the improvements, is the cumulative effect of things that General Kiani has been trying to do, and General Musharraf was trying to do, and our own ODRP people and commanders in CENTCOM have been trying to do. For nearly a decade, it's beginning to have an impact. So I see a much more uneven picture than the sort of hockey stick trajectory that Haider's talking about. Musharraf was preoccupied with his survival in office in 2007-2008 period, but not for the period, not for the 2002 to 2006. There was a matter of taking this huge organization, the Pakistan Army, and reorienting it. You know how hard it is to reorient a huge bureaucratic organization, because most of you work for one. And they had to do the same thing with vastly fewer resources. In 2001, the Pakistan military was a hollow shell, because we had been denying them equipment and parts and support for a decade. And how they kept those few F-16s they had in the air during the 1990s is a great story. But they really didn't have much. The reason they used brutal force against the people was A, that's all they had. B, we told them to do it. So I got to know Kiani in 2003, 2004. Brilliant officer, one of the best generals I've ever met. And I think we still have a chance. We still have a good shot at it because we've got the best people now on both sides. They know each other, they understand each other. If the political side of both the Pakistani and the Afghan governments can come up to just an adequate level of government, Sorry, I kept you over time.
Do you have a last word?
No, I think there, most of what you said, we gave, you know, in this kind of format, I have to cover a lot of...
Understood.
And when you look at the long picture, you know, when you approach, General Cutter, for example, Director General of Analysis, was in charge of the 2005 operation in South Sierra. We had two major meetings, extensively told me exactly how we did. And he would tell me that the Corps Commander would call me up and say, oh my God, there was another attack. Go and destroy that village. There were Punjabi officers who came to me and said that when we went, it felt like an invasion. So the ethnic angle of how, this is all, so even when they would have these tactical games, because they lacked the overarching strategy, you know Kiani, you also know Musharraf. You know the kind of attention he gave to any kind of bombing plan versus Kiani's plan that was first hatched in late 2008, and the kind of proteges that he's had around and how they're implementing. It's like, you know, it's a sea change. That's what I was talking about. Obviously, there were major tactical gains, and frankly, just like Iraq, when things were going really bad in 2006, there were brilliant lieutenant colonels and company commanders who would be writing all these amazing lessons learned that I've tried this thing, I picked up trash, and now the people like me, or I did this. So it wasn't like an awakening where Petraeus writes the thing, sends it back, and all of a sudden this organization changes. I think the same thing was happening because these young officers are now full colonels, and they would say, you know what, I tried something different in lower or say agency or at least, and it went. Others who went in and said, they were very frank about it. They said, I walked in, and one of the Punjabi officer told me, the full colonel, he walked in and he said, I couldn't understand a single person because all of them were pursued. And the first guy the insurgents killed was my translator. And I was hunkered down and they just kind of looked at me and we just said a few things that, you know, obviously they know basic English and they basically saved his life. And he went back and he said, the least I'm going to do is try to understand these people. And that's the contradiction is because you grow up with Pashtuns in the army, but they're Pashtuns who have been away from many of these areas, and those are all nuances. But I agree with you. It's that even today they were saying we were ready to go to South Waziristan. When the Americans came and they made it very public, hey, go to South Waziristan. So they said, okay, we're going to wait a month because we're going to enjoy this 80% approval rating. We're not going to go at the behest of the, and you know this part very well, and I've found some brilliant people at ORP and people who just don't see eye to eye anymore and have stayed there for about a year and are jaded and have these preconceived notions and they're sticking with them. Others who are very adaptive and are opening up, and I'm sure they would benefit immensely if you were to go back to the U.S. Embassy.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
For further information, please contact Dr. Amin Tarzi, Director of Middle East Studies at tarzia@grc.usmcu.edu or Adam C. Seitz, Senior Research Associate, Middle East Studies at seitzac@grc.usmcu.edu.